The U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson will, in fact, be in Fairbanks.
The Arctic Council is set to meet in Fairbanks as the U.S. prepares to give up its chairmanship of the group. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, April 28th. Good evening. I'm Ann Hillman. Also tonight, President Trump moves to undo Obama-era restrictions on Arctic offshore oil and gas drilling.
It's going to lead to a lot of great wealth for our country and a lot of great jobs.
Those more stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
President Trump signed an order today that lifts the restrictions his predecessor imposed on drilling off Alaska's Arctic shores. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
Thank you, Mike.
The signing ceremony was in the White House Roosevelt Room. Congress members from oil states crowded around the president, including the full Alaska delegation.
It's going to lead to a lot of great wealth for our country and a lot of great jobs for our country. So God bless America. Thank you very much.
Trump then signed the order calling for an America First offshore energy strategy. He gave Senator Lisa Murkowski the pen. The order tells the Interior Secretary to reconsider the removal of the Arctic from the offshore leasing plan, and it rescinds a ban by President Obama excluding much of the Arctic from future lease sales. Conservation groups maintain Obama's ban was permanent. Wilderness Society Arctic Director Lois Epstein says they intend to sue.
There's a number of organizations. We're prepared to do everything we can do to stop the opening of the Arctic Ocean to drilling.
Trump's order also calls for a review of the Arctic-specific offshore drilling regs and of the blowout prevention rule imposed after the 2010 Gulf oil spill. Epstein says rolling back that rule would give advantage to the least safe operators.
That's tragic, really, and can result in situations like the BP Deepwater Horizon, where you had 11 deaths and over 200 million gallons released.
Senator Murkowski says the rule is only slated for review. She especially likes that Trump's order announces a national policy of encouraging energy exploration and production. She acknowledges other barriers remain for the offshore Arctic.
This is the first step. We don't have any producers that are sitting poised to move.
Senator Dan Sullivan says when Obama imposed the Arctic drilling ban, the administration didn't even tell him in advance.
What a difference 5 months makes.
Not only was he at the White House for the signing ceremony, but Sullivan says afterward the president invited him into the Oval Office. He says he thanked Trump for lifting Obama's Arctic ban so quickly.
And the president mentioned, you know, that day in December when the former president did this, the Russians must have been very excited. And I said, I think they were excited.
Alaska Congressman Don Young is pleased with the order, too, but he's a little peeved Trump kept them waiting in the Roosevelt Room.
I would say 20 minutes. He was late. I don't appreciate even the president being late. You know how I am.
Young says they spent the time talking to the vice president and two cabinet secretaries. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
United States Secretary of State Rex Tillerson will be in Fairbanks next month during the Week of the Arctic. Fairbanks Borough Mayor Special Assistant Jeff Stepp broke the news at a borough assembly meeting Thursday night.
Today at a conference in Virginia, the Ambassador David Bolton announced that the U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson will in fact be in Fairbanks.
The Week of the Arctic is a series of events, workshops, and presentations tied to the Arctic Council, an international body representing 8 circumpolar nations. The United States is concluding its chairmanship of the Council and, following tradition, will host a meeting as the next country takes over. That meeting is scheduled for Fairbanks the week of May 8th. Finland is taking over the chairmanship. Stepp says all the circumpolar nations will be represented, including Russia.
The Ministry of Foreign Affairs of the Russian Federation has also confirmed that Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov will also attend. In fact, all 8 foreign ministers of the Arctic Council nations are expected to be present in Fairbanks.
Stepp, who is part of a local team preparing for the Week of the Arctic, told the assembly the eyes of the world will be on Fairbanks during the event. A State Department official declined to confirm that Tillerson would be attending. Spokesperson Nicole Thompson wrote in an email, quote, "If there are plans for the secretary to travel to Alaska, they would likely be made public in coming days/weeks. The state's budget problem is shrinking, but it may not be enough to resolve differences between the Senate and the House. Higher oil prices have cut the projected gap between what the state government spends and what it raises. Senate Finance Committee co-chair Anna McKinnon says the state has time to close its budget gap if it passes Senate Bill 26 this year. The measure draws money from permanent fund earnings to pay for state government and limits permanent fund dividends.
It is short-sighted to be thinking about an income tax at this point in time.
The Senate's bill would leave a gap of roughly $400 million in 9 years, according to a forecasting model used by the nonpartisan Legislative Finance Division. The gap is about $200 million less than it was projected to be before state officials updated their forecast last week. The Senate majority proposes to close the rest of the gap by cutting spending, while the House majority would rather reintroduce an income tax and raise oil and gas taxes. The original version of SB 26 sets permanent fund dividends at $1,000. The House version would set dividends $250 higher. House Finance Committee co-chair Paul Seaton says that even with the improved forecast, the legislature must pass an income tax to have a balanced budget in the long term. He says not doing so would leave the state with capital budgets that are too low, and it would leave residents with PFDs that are also unnecessarily low.
If you don't have an adequate capital budget and you're limiting the dividend to the lowest amount that anybody has proposed, then you're not getting much input into the economy to bring us out of recession.
The House Finance Committee plans to compare the House and Senate plans next week, while the Senate Finance Committee is scheduled to discuss a bill to revise oil and gas tax credits. The legislature is 12 days past the scheduled end to session. The session has 19 days left before it must end under the state constitution. On Thursday night, the Mat-Su Borough Assembly held its third and final public hearing on its annual budget at a special meeting in Willow. KTNA's Philip Manning was there and has more.
Nearly 70 people came out for the final public hearing on the Mat-Su Borough's budget at the Willow Community Center on Thursday. The majority of those who spoke focused on one line item, schools. Overall, the borough budget has shrunk by several million dollars, but the proposed level of funding for the Mat-Su Borough School District is the same as last year's budget. Over a dozen parents, teachers, and school administrators say that still isn't enough. Talkeetna Elementary School Principal Lisa Shelby says keeping the funding the same is essentially a cut.
Flat funding results in more cuts to the tune of $3.4 million and fewer opportunities for our kids. What I'm asking of you will take courage to put kids and families at the top of your list.
The district is asking the borough to cover that $3.4 million gap. In recent years, the Mat-Su Borough has met the request from the school district for increased funding. But this year, members of the assembly say that simply isn't possible. Here's Assemblymember Jim Sykes.
But right now, for the amount of money that is being asked for, I don't see where it is. And I've been through the budget for a little bit. There might be some, but I don't want to give people false hopes on this count.
The reason Assemblymember Sykes and others say the money isn't there is due to the borough's revenue cap. Each year, the total amount the Mat-Su Borough can raise in tax revenue has a ceiling based on population growth and the cost of living index for Anchorage. This year's budget is at that cap. Assemblymember Randall Kowalki says that means it's not a question of finding additional revenue.
So if we take money and give it to the school, it's coming from somewhere else.
With the borough in a position where it cannot increase education funding without cutting elsewhere, Mayor Vern Halter says it's critical that the Alaska legislature not carry through with a proposed 5% cut to schools as proposed by the state senate.
That would be backwards. That would be the direction we don't want to go. They're talking about even hitting some of the student allocation funding, which would be a backwards step. That would increase the debt of our school district by several million dollars more.
There is the possibility of some increase to school funding, though not the full amount being requested. Assemblymember Dan Mayfield says the school site selection fund, which currently has just under $2 million in it, is not likely to be needed anytime soon, and that the money could be moved to the school district's operating budget. Mayfield says he plans to make an amendment to move those funds when the assembly begins budget deliberations on Monday. In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, UAF scientists help unravel the mystery of Antarctica's Blood Falls.
It's kind of an iconic feature within the landscape that has been a puzzle since the first Antarctic explorers.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
The Alaska Department of Fish and Game's commercial sockeye salmon outlook for this year is predicting Upper Cook Inlet fishermen will have their lowest harvest in the past 15 years. The Peninsula Clarion reported earlier this week that the outlook predicts a total run of 4 million fish to all stream systems in the inlet. Commercial fishermen are projected to harvest about 1.7 million fish. The outlook shows Kenai River predictions are not matching the levels reached throughout the past 10 years. The river is projected to see only 2.2 million fish, which is nearly 40% below its 10-year average. Last year's total harvest by all groups was about 3.3 million fish. The outlook prediction had been 5.3 million. Southeast Alaska's regional tribal government is developing its business side. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska President Richard Peterson said funding cuts threaten its programs. He said about 9/10 of the council's money comes from federal sources, and most of the rest comes from the state.
That's just not sustainable. That's not sufficient. So we're working on alternative sources of revenue.
The Central Council has about 30,000 tribal members in Alaska, the Pacific Northwest, and elsewhere in the lower 48. Addressing the organization's recent tribal assembly in Juneau, Peterson said it needs to maintain its social service, justice, and training efforts. But that's not all.
We want to not just preserve programs that we have, but expand and grow. And if we're going to do that, we need that economic self-sufficiency, that economic sovereignty.
That effort is being spearheaded by Tlingit Haida's Tribal Business Corporation. CEO Richard Reinhardt said there's growth because the organization purchased the government services business Kira last summer. He said its main customer is the U.S. Department of Defense.
We are running power plants, water systems, water treatment plants. We have dozens of electricians, dozens of plumbers, and a couple dozen of carpenters. We do vehicle maintenance, grounds maintenance. We do complete base operation services.
Kira has offices in the Bahamas, as well as Colorado and several other states. Founder Carlos Garcia, who continues to be its president, said the company has about 600 employees. He said it's expanding because tribal ownership allows it to bid for contracts under the 8A Disadvantaged Business Program.
We're going to need good employees, both native and non-native. And I see in this room many, many people from all over the areas you represent that can help us.
He asked the 100 or so tribal assembly delegates to point potential applicants to the company's job openings. But he said Kira is a business purchased to make money for the Central Council, not an employment program. I'm Ed Schoenfeld, reporting in Juneau.
At a borough meeting Tuesday night, a new payment in lieu of taxes agreement was struck between the Northwest Arctic Borough and Teck Alaska, the operator of Red Dog Mine. For the next 10 years, the borough will receive annual payments from Teck Alaska based on a fixed asset value of Red Dog Mine. The payments are estimated to be between $14 and $18 million per year. Previous payments were $11.6 million annually. Wayne Hall is superintendent for environment and community relations with Teck Alaska.
There was a previous PILT agreement that was for 5 years, which expired a year and a half ago, and we've been under a severance tax until this new agreement has come into effect with the approval of the ordinance on Tuesday.
In addition, Teck Alaska will create a village improvement fund to be distributed by the borough toward community services and infrastructure with input from its 11 villages. The fund will be opened with $11 million and will receive between $4 and $8 million per year based on a certain percentage of Red Dog's gross profits. The total payment will be $20 to $26 million per year. Hall says it's also retroactive to January 1st of 2016. Red Dog Mine sits on land owned by the Nana Regional Corporation and has been in operation since 1989. According to the corporation's website, during the mine's existence, Nana has received $1.3 billion in net proceeds payments from the mine and distributed $820 million of that to other shareholders and corporations. Scientists from the University of Alaska Fairbanks and Colorado College have unraveled the mystery of a red waterfall in Antarctica. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the research unveils mechanisms potentially at work in other polar glaciers.
University of Alaska Fairbanks glaciologist Aaron Pettit led a team that traveled to the bottom of the world to study Blood Falls.
This feature is so prominent. It's the place that everybody knows about. It's kind of an iconic feature within the landscape that has been a puzzle since the first Antarctic explorers.
Blood Falls is at the end of Taylor Glacier, about 30 kilometers from the ocean, but the area was covered by seawater over a million years ago. Pettit says the surface ice of Blood Falls today is salty and iron-rich, just like the ancient ocean.
That was the big puzzle. How do you get this salty ice from the bottom up into the glacier and then out the top?
Pettit says the current project began with earlier research on the Taylor Glacier.
We had a little bit of data left over from this first project 15 years ago that suggested we might be able to use ground penetrating radar to study it more.
My role in this when I was down there was I helped to operate several of the instruments and make field observations.
UAF PhD candidate Christina Carr says radar signals sent into the ice did not bounce back, but were instead absorbed.
And we interpret this as being ice that's got a lot of salt in it or a lot of little salty pockets of water.
Confirmation of liquid water in such a cold glacier was unprecedented and believed to be the result of its high salt concentration and energy given off as surrounding ice tries to freeze it.
It's just like you have to put heat into water to boil it. If you try and freeze water, you have to take heat out, and that heat has to go somewhere.
Water is the key mechanism by which glaciers change, and Pettit says the Blood Falls research expands our understanding of its potential.
Basically shows us that water can persist and play this really important role in even in the most extreme cold polar environments.
Pettit says the next step is trying to understand how pressure differences and crevasses in the ice move water through the glacier. The research project was funded by the National Science Foundation. A paper about the findings is published in the Journal of Glaciology. Its lead author is team member Jessica Badgley of Colorado College. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. At Alaska Pacific University, students are surrounded by beauty, distinguished faculty, and independent-minded creative students pursuing higher education. AlaskaPacific.edu, moving life forward with APU. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamut.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, birch syrup. The chartreuse leaves of the birch tree are one of the first signs of spring in south central Alaska. But for a few weeks before the leaves unfurl, the trees offer a sweet treat, a watery liquid that when tapped and boils down, turns into a rich, nutty syrup. Reporter Daisha Eaton has more on how birch syrup is becoming a favorite flavor in the state's budding local food scene.
At Wild Scoop's Test Kitchen near downtown Anchorage, an ice cream machine whirs as Alyssa Brown prepares to drizzle birch syrup into chilled sweet cream.
Okay, so now the time has come to extract it. It looks sort of soft-servey. We have a container that we're going to pour it into that we've pre-chilled.
The artisanal ice cream company started in 2015, making locally inspired ice creams and sorbets. Brown says one of the most exciting parts of her job is formulating the flavors.
We have made so many flavors. We're always making new ones. We have probably about 25 in the kitchen at any given time, but hundreds in our repertoire.
Some use local products, locally baked chocolate treats, for example, to create rich concoctions with Alaska-themed names like Sitka Swirl and Turnagain Mudflats. Others are made with wild ingredients only found in the far north, like spruce tip and wild berry kombucha sorbet. Brown says those wild-crafted local ingredients are key, like late-run birch syrup, which she uses in several ice creams.
It's a really nice balance of the creaminess of the vanilla and the sharpness of the birch, which is sort of unexpected. It's not quite like maple syrup. It's not like balsamic syrup. It's not like molasses, but it's something that's totally unique and very Alaskan.
Brown says the idea for the birch syrup ice cream came early on when they were approached by a small company in Homer, Bridge Creek Birch Syrup. About 200 miles south of Anchorage, on a cool spring morning at the bottom of a hillside overlooking the town of Homer and Kachemak Bay, clear birch sap empties through a series of PVC pipes down the hillside and into a giant holding tank in the back of a pickup truck. Jake Bowden collects liquid sap from birch trees into hundreds of gallon plastic bags, then after 24 hours empties the bags into 5-gallon buckets.
There's about 650 trees up there, and it's just a bunch of tubing, and we collect into 5-gallon buckets and haul it over and dump it in a barrel, and then it all gravity feeds down into the truck tank right here.
Turning the clear, watery sap of the birch into a nutty, sweet syrup, though, is a huge process, powered by fire.
So this is basically like a giant wood stove. If we're doing this in the olden days, this would be a wood stove with a pot on top, but it's a little more complicated than that. What, can you explain how it works?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. It's just a big forced air stove that's 2 feet wide and 6 feet long.
Back at a small building near Bowden's house, birch sap flows from the 300-gallon collection tank into a custom-made boiler inside a shop he endearingly calls the evaporatorium.
As the sap flows in, it's constantly being evaporated off at about 50 gallons an hour. So we're adding 50 gallons of new sap as it's, every hour as it's evaporating. So it's constantly concentrating, and all the sugars are, flowing through these different compartments, and they all get pushed forward until it reaches the front bay.
What started off as a hobby for he and his partner, Anna Meredith, has turned into a small business that takes over their lives for 2 or 3 weeks each spring.
The big thing with maple and birch that people don't realize is that it takes twice the amount of sap to make a gallon of syrup. So it's definitely a different creature. It's different sugars and so different nutrients, different minerals, because it's a different tree.
This is the late run.
That's really good. Yeah, it's hard to describe it though. It's like,
yeah, good.
It's
luck.
Like a lot. It tastes like bright. It yeah. tastes. You can tell it's like the sun is coming out. It's springtime.
Yeah, the buds.
It's kind of tangy.
Yeah.
Meredith traveled to the first ever International Birch Syrup Conference held in the Adirondacks in upstate New York in 2015, where their syrup took first place in the late run category. Once it's finished off on the propane burner, the syrup is cooled and emptied into jugs and smaller bottles for food businesses like Wild Scoops in Anchorage. Alyssa Brown says the local treat is doing more than just adding flavor to their ice cream.
The birch syrup is just a small part about what we do, but I think it captures our love for this sense of place, our love for Alaska, and this growing excitement about using products that grow here. Using products and ingredients and wild ingredients that are unique to Alaska.
She says the ice cream company is expanding from their smaller test kitchen off Gamble to a storefront location downtown this summer, and at least two birch-themed flavors will be on the menu. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week we're hearing from Taylor Holman in Unalaska. Holman is a high school senior and placed first place in Alaska's Russian language competition this year.
So I first started taking Russian my freshman year actually because I had cross country after school and I didn't want to do PE and cross country. So I switched into Russian and that's kind of where it all started, I guess. It seemed like a really cool language. It's pretty practical when you're living here in Alaska, so I just thought it was a good choice. Learning a whole new alphabet was difficult at first, but my first year in Russian, it only took 2 or 3 weeks to really go through all the letters and learn their sounds. But now it's pretty natural to read it. You read it in script and then in print also. So script is more like a cursive and then print is what they type in. Well, one phrase that I remember in particular coming in handy just recently, I was at the Russian competition and they asked you to tell it about yourself. So then I told about myself and then they asked me what my dream was. I didn't remember specifically how to say dream. And I remember this thing, like, this is my dream, is Eta Maya Mechta. So then I just felt like really lucky that I was able to remember that just from freshman year. And that was just one of the phrases that like stuck with me for some reason. I am the outreach coordinator for the Unalaska Visitor Center. What happens with that is we meet passengers that come off of ferries and cruise ships. And one time there was these people that came off the cruise ship and they were speaking in Russian. And I was able to tell them that like we have maps and that I'm able to provide them with any directions that they would need and just like situations like that, just being able to use it in little like phrases and stuff just to be able to get by.
Меня зовут Taylor Holman. Я живу в Уналашке.
My name is Taylor Holman and I live in Unalaska.
49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Daisha Eaton, Laura Craigle, and Wesley Early. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
That's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Andrew Kitchenman and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Dan Bross and Robert Hannon in Fairbanks, Davis Hovey in Nome, and Philip Manning in Talkeetna. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork, Sean Dugan's our editor and producer, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Ann Hellman. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.